Eclipse Audio, pissing off the neighbors since 1946.
We know your relationship with Klipsch dates back a few years, but what are a few of your fondest memories of Klipsch?
Well, I guess it all started with the phone call that I got from Paul. I had heard about Klipsch, and I knew that he was a giant, and here he was calling me on the phone wanting to know if he could come and see me. And that was a monumental change in my life, because he flew his plane up and spent the day. I was scared to death, because I'm figuring, man, he is just going to chew me up in little pieces. Because he asked me, he said, "Are you the guy that's got that 20,000 watt PA?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he says, "Well, I want to come and see it." And I'm going, "Oh, boy." Because it was just, we were amateurs putting this stuff together. I didn't know, but worked. Macintosh amps and A4 Altex, a bunch of JBL horns. But anyway, he didn't do that all day. He's asking me questions. Why did you do this? Well, how come you do that? Well, how come you did that? I found out later from Bob, when we got down to Hope, Arkansas, that he flew me back there that night. I stayed there, went out to the plant, and the next day, it was like, it was an incredible world for me. I'd never been in this kind of world. He took me out to his private lab, and Bob, his plant manager, told me then, he said, he has never heard rock and roll. He won't allow us to play anything this loud or like that. But he was inquisitive. He wanted to know what was going on, and because it was a world he'd never touched, and it was audio. And he changed my life. He taught me a lot just in those 2 days, pointing me to the Bell Lab studies and Fletcher Munson curves and how our ears work. And he taught me how to listen. I'd already had great training in that in the years of tuning theater organs, voicing an organ. You got to really be able to listen to the harmonics. And he was an organ and fashionado also. Well, there you go. Wait a minute. Two peas in a pod. But, of course, he was so much of a kind person to me. I was expecting much different. But I never had any kind of moments like that with him. He was great. And it started a long relationship with Paul.
So just kind of a follow-up to that, do you think maybe you related to each other a little bit over your lack of being rock and roll people? Do you think that was a bonding experience for the two of you, or was it well beyond that?
Well, that was the whole thing. He and I were kind of on the same platform in that we were both looking at it as a science project, I guess. It was how to make better audio. Paul and I were looking at it from the aspect of the engineering side of what could be put together to make it sound better. Why did we do this? How come we have to do that? Applying the science to it. Whereas the only thing that had been happening so far is people were just tossing things together, plugging this to that, oh, that sounds okay. Well, it might have sounded okay. But Paul taught me how to make it sound better. And I will never forget that. And he, on that first meeting at his plant, when he flew me down there, as we were leaving, that was his comment to me. He said, "Well, I hope that these last couple of days have helped you, and maybe you can make things sound better." And that was, I guess, the opening sentence that started our relationship, making it sound better.
With all these leaps and bounds for live sound and for these audio systems and touring systems, maybe some specific influences, how much did Paul Klipsch have in your decisions at that time?
I relied on him a lot when it would come to making a different in design or setting things up. He taught me how to splay horns, how to aim them so we could get the maximum use of the horns. He also got me into, I was just using the horn I had. They were JBLs. I didn't know. But he taught me, no, use a 20-degree horn and it'll go further to the back. Use a 60-degree horn. Use a 90-degree horn up front. And that really changed things. And I always relate it to a water hose. You take a nozzle and you can spray it real far. But, of course, it's not a lot of water, but it gets out there. It's a stream. But then if you widen it out, it will spray a whole lot more up front, but it doesn't go back as far. Sound does the same thing. And Paul taught me about that. I didn't know. And our sound system became much louder, less power, more efficient, just because of what I learned from Paul. And then he pointed me to listen and look and learn from all the people before him, even. And that was the thing. He was not a I know it all and you know nothing guy. He was always inquisitive when I was around him, asking questions about why we did this or why we did that, and then teaching me how to do it better.
Do you think that Mr. Clips kind of taught you how to teach other people? I mean, do you kind of follow that same mindset when you work with younger engineers and inventors?
Oh, absolutely. I do a lot of workshops. I do a couple a week on Skype to different clubs and people and podcasts. And I learned how to explain some of this from Paul. He was good at helping me understand things, and if he could tell if you didn't get it, he would stop and ask me and start over again. And it was an incredible experience to be in front of him and learn all of these different things that I didn't know about, and it was all science.
So let's talk about moving beyond science and getting involved with the Grateful Dead. What was your involvement with the Wall of Sound?
Well, the Grateful Dead had this situation where they came out on a short Midwest to East Coast tour, and they played that first night in New Orleans. And Owsley, their sound guy, who owned the sound gear and did all the mixing and setup and stuff, he was on probation, and he wasn't supposed to be out of the state of California. Well, the DEA found out about it. And I think the FBI, they show up at the show and sit in the back row, and they waited till the show was over. And the band comes on to St. Louis for the next night while Owsley was tearing things down and loading the truck. As he had it all loaded and padlocked the back of his truck, the FBI and the DEA padlocked him, took him, the equipment, and the truck off back to California. The band knew nothing about this. They get to the Fox Theater in St. Louis 4 o'clock next day. Where's Owsley? We didn't have cell phones in those days. Didn't have great communications as we do today. And surprisingly enough, there was no Owsley. And they started calling and found out there isn't going to be an Owsley. And, oh, it goes back to a few years before that, of course, many years before that, I was the organist at the Fox Theater, at that very Fox Theater. It started when I was 15. And it was amazing the way this happened. Long about, it would have been 67, I paid a visit there. I stopped by to see my old friends that worked there, because I hadn't been playing there in 5 or 6 years. And I stopped in, and they had all these speakers out in the alley, and I'm going to George Bales. And I said, George, what are you doing here? What's all this? Oh, we're putting in a new sound system, and we're throwing all that stuff out. So you're throwing those away? Yeah, we've got newer ones. I said, can I have them? Now, this was early in my music shop career. But the ham radio in me's going, wait a minute, don't throw anything away. So I went and got a truck, and I hauled those Altec A4s. He had four of them. I hauled those to Marissa, and I started building this PA. I had heard, I didn't know anything about all that. It was just a big hi-fi system to me. I had heard Macintosh was a good amplifier, so I went and bought a bunch of Macintoshes and had this little mixer thing that wasn't very much. But we put this all together, and gosh, it worked. And then it went on, and that's what we did the James Gang with, and that's a whole nother story. But along comes this night that the dead came to St. Louis with no PA. So George Bales calls me 4 o'clock in the afternoon. "You still have those big speakers? Did you ever get them to work?" And I said, "Yes, sir. What's the deal?" "Well, talk to this guy. They came in here last night and they didn't have a PA. Their PA didn't make it." So, okay. I talked to, he handed the phone to Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, because I didn't know who it was, and barely knew who they were then. I wasn't really in tune with some of that music or those artists. And it became an incredible relationship. Jerry said to me, I told him what I had, and I remember him saying, "You have Macintosh amplifiers?" "Yeah," and I told him about the A4s and all that. "Well, get it up here." So we got it up there. It was about 9 o'clock that night. Before we got there, we were an hour and 20 minutes from the Fox. So we set up, and wow, that was really good. I was amazed how good it sounded in that big theater. And my great Fox, it was like my mother. I'd been there so many years playing the theater organ in between the movies. And it started a great relationship. We headed out of there that night, went on this short tour on out to the East Coast. Jerry would come to St. Louis. If he came through, he would call me. We'd go pick him up. He'd come down to Marissa. We had a great relationship, and it was all because of Paul helping me to get those A4s and those JBL horns playing right, doing right, sounding better, power distribution. I didn't know about that. And that was all because of Paul. But again, the Grateful Dead night was really sensational. And there's an article written, you can dial it up, "The Night Rock and Roll Sound Was Born." And it's all about that night at the Fox. So that's how it all happened. We hit the front page of Billboard, and the rest is kind of history.
You're listening to WPWK, Loud and Proud.
Let's talk a little bit about your involvement with the Wall of Sound.
Well, they were talking about it. Jerry came to Marissa once, and in fact, Pigpen was with him and several other guys, and we were discussing this. They had this idea of having a PA for each guy, was really what it was. Each band member would have his own stack behind him, his own PA system. And we talked about it. However, right before they really started instituting all of that, I got the call from The Who, and I was off on the road with The Who, so I never personally got physically involved with the Wall of Sound. Owsley took it from there, and several other guys, but I never got involved with it other than the initial talk and plans and thoughts of what would and what wouldn't work.
When we talk about, you know, the night rock and roll sound was born, and then now, in your everyday life, I mean, you see, I don't know how many shows a year, but you definitely see a few. All these advancements, how do you see those played out? Do you see the skeletal work that you guys put in?
Oh, absolutely. After we had made that Billboard article and everybody was starting to learn about this little music store in Marissa, Ye Old Music Shop, they started paying attention, because obviously if it was something that garnered the attention of the Grateful Dead and all these other great groups that followed, they paid attention, and it was then pretty well known that Paul Klipp should help me improve it, because he had read, I guess he had read this thing in Billboard is how we got together, because I never asked him that, but it was a pretty big talk in the audio world when we hit the scene with the Dead and the Who and all of this. And that was the deal with the whole situation of outsiders learning about this little music store. And a couple of days into that tour with the Dead, Jerry called me and he said, "Hey, what is this ye old music shop?" It was all over the cabinet, you know, the name of the store, because I used that to promote my store. He said, we have a tough time pronouncing all that. We're just going to call you Heil Sound. Is that okay?" And I said, "Absolutely." So really, it was Jerry Garcia that named my company. And then it became a separate company. Heil Sound was totally separate from the retail music store, Ye Old Music Shop. But everybody was paying attention. And then we started building our own equipment. And it was very much of the design of Paul. So much so, when it came to the speakers, he told me what I needed to do. I went to the company that was building his speakers, Eminence. He said, "You tell them this, what you want." He gave me the numbers. He told me how to do free air cone resonance, which then we could take that and build our own cabinets, because we wanted cabinets that were portable. We wanted cabinets that would take a lot of, you know, a lot of wear and tear, which we did. We built thousands of speakers and mixers and amplifiers. We were the first companies to do modular mixers, so if channel 5 blows up in the middle of your gig, you don't have to shut the system down. You just unplug it, grab a spare that you would get when you bought the mixer from us, and you're back on the air. Send that defective channel back, and away we go. Also had an outboard power supply, so if the power supply went dead, bet no problem. Well, Paul gave me those ideas to make things happen, and we did. And it became very, very much the scene. We've sold lots of equipment. I have a number of guys I still know. They're not in the business anymore, but they would come to Marissa with a truck, and when they left there, they could do a gig. We were some of the first to build snakes, multi-cord, so you can put the mixer in the back of the hall. Nobody was doing that yet. They were mixing on stage. We were the first guys to do monitors, because I understood how monitors should work and how to make them work. And Jerry and I worked on that. That was something he really thought was cool. How come I could do this? Because I applied antenna theory from my amateur radio. Phasing. And Paul refined that knowledge I had into audio. It's the same thing. It's just a different frequency. And if you run this monitor system out of phase, it reduces the feedback by many, many decibel. So all of those things happened around that Dead concert, even though we weren't on the tour with them much after that. But I stayed in touch with them, and it was something that there was a synergy between Jerry and I. I wasn't in their culture, but they knew when they came to me, I had a soldering iron, and I can make them sound better, and I could drive the truck, and I did.
Let's talk a little bit about the Grateful Dead. I mean, they're very close to playing their final three shows at Soldier Field in Chicago. So what do you think the largest contribution to the rock and roll landscape has been?
Well, first of all, their music is very, very complex. It's not a hard rock four chords and a vocalist out there. No, their music is extremely complex. A couple of them were schooled as symphony musicians. I mean, they really changed the direction for many musicians, because it was so complex, and it I think the coolest part of the Dead were they were so kind to their fans. My goodness, if you'd go into a rock and roll show in the 70s with a tape recorder, they'd arrest you. It's like, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
The Dead, we had plugs on the mixer and that we could plug recorders into. They invited people to record their shows and share them. And I thought that was wonderful. It was very different. That whole peace love scene of Woodstock carried through to the Grateful Dead. And it still does today. I met up several times with Bob Weir. And it's that same cool attitude, I guess is the word. And they're so kind. And many people that wouldn't know them have no idea of how they are personally. They wouldn't expect that, maybe. No, they are wonderful guys.
What are you working on these days? What's the next big move for Heil Sound?
Well, I'm working on some things for our amateur radio division, which is a very important part of the company. And we continue to bring our large diaphragm dynamics to the front of the pro world and the broadcast industry, as well as the podcast industry, has really picked up. They finally figured it out, because all the old line microphones that broadcasters have been using for years, they're all made offshore and they're not as good as they were. So their reputation that we grew up with of these are really great aren't. And the new technology we bring, the rear rejection of the large dynamics is amazing. With 40 dB of rear rejection, the broadcasters love that. And it's our own pattern, and it's omni across the front, so you can move a whole 180 degrees around the front and you don't drop out. And you got this great rear with super articulation in the speech voicing range. You don't have to EQ it a lot. That was learned from Paul. I learned that from Paul. He taught me what I needed to know. You go to the Bell Lab studies of Fletcher and Munson and learn what is happening inside your ears. That was an important part when we started designing these microphones. So that continues on each day. We're very happy and blessed with all of what's going on in that division.
Do you have any inspiring words for anybody wanting to start out maybe in this crazy industry?
Well, if you start out in this crazy industry, you really need to learn some of the basics of how our ears work, what happens when in the speaker world, what happens with the directivity, the reflections, all of the things that most people aren't talking about. They just say, oh, it sounds good. Why does it sound good? You have to learn why. Because if you know what makes a good speaker sound good, maybe you can tweak those little refinements and make it sound better. That's what Paul Klipsch taught Bob Heil, and I was very blessed that happened.
WPWK, brought to you by Klipsch Audio.